May it please the court, for the record, Mark Walta, registration number 30990, appearing on behalf of Danny Shea, the appellant in this matter. This is a COCA prosecution of a prison gang. There are three issues on appeal, technically four, I suppose. The third issue regards to sentencing issues. I won't be talking about those absent questions from the court. The state has confessed error as to the extraordinary risk issue. There's a merger issue that I think has been sufficiently presented on the briefs. Therefore, I'm going to focus on the right to counsel issue, as well as the asserted violation under the UMDDA. I'll begin with the right to counsel issue. When this case first commenced, the district court exercised its authority under 21.1031B to appoint ADC to represent Mr. Shea. Approximately 3 months into the litigation, the prosecution filed a motion challenging defendant's eligibility for state-funded legal services. The challenge ultimately succeeded in forcing Mr. Shea to part ways with his court-appointed lawyer and to expend funds on private counsel. At all times during the 4 years of trial proceedings in this case, Mr. Shea was in custody and unable to make bail. The question presented is whether defendants in Colorado, regardless of their financial circumstances, are entitled to counsel at state expense when they are in custody and unable to make or not allowed bail. If the court agrees with us that the question should be answered in the affirmative, then it must conclude that Mr. Shea was deprived his right of counsel, which is a structural error warranting reversal. There are three issues that must be resolved along the way. The first issue is whether or not the prosecution had the standing or legal authority to prompt a reassessment of defendant's eligibility for court-appointed counsel. The second issue is whether Mr. Shea in fact qualified as eligible under the applicable standards and guidelines. And the third question is, if so, can he be deemed to have effectively waived his right to counsel at state expense? Addressing the first question, prosecution had no standing or legal authority to challenge eligibility in this case. There's simply no mechanism for the prosecution to trigger reassessment of eligibility once counsel has been appointed. The prosecution can challenge the initial determination of eligibility pursuant to 21.3.3. But once eligibility is established and counsel is appointed, the only mechanism for revisiting the issue or the procedure set forth in CJD 0404, Roman numeral 2F. 2F contemplates a reassessment of eligibility only when an attorney or other person appointed to assist a defendant comes into possession of information that calls into question the defendant's indigent status. There's nothing in the provision suggesting that the prosecution can prompt such a reassessment.
Mr. Walta, if the court comes upon information other than those two sources, is it required to ignore that information?
It raises an interesting question, and I've certainly thought about this in the context of two. I suppose the other scenario would be, what if the prosecution brings the information to the attention of defense counsel? What is the obligation of defense counsel? I think 2F makes that clear. But if for some reason defense counsel decided not to make the challenge or force the reassessment, would the prosecutor then have grounds to force the reassessment? I don't know that I can definitively answer it, but the problem that arises is, first of all, there's the perception, and this goes to, I think, public perceptions of the criminal justice system, that when prosecutors are permitted to force these sorts of reassessments, there's the perception that indigent defendants are being deprived or is attempting to deprive the defendant of their lawyer of choice. There's the concern that it could be used as a tactic to deny defendants of effective and competent representation. And then, of course, there's simply the sense of unequal justice in that indigent defendants are being exposed to a sort of scrutiny that non-indigent defendants are not. But the bigger problem, I think, in this case is that Mr. Shea, in fact, met the standards and guidelines for indigency. Attachment C to CJD 0404 makes clear that he automatically qualified it as indigent. And what the attachment makes clear is that there are two scenarios in which the public defender can automatically elect to represent a defendant. The first one is when the defendant is in custody and cannot post or is not allowed bail, which focuses solely on the defendant's custodial status. The second, perhaps more common one, is when the defendant completes the JDF 208 form and is deemed to meet the income eligibility requirements, which obviously focus on the defendant's financial circumstances. The first scenario has nothing to do with the defendant's financial circumstances. All the public defender is required to do is to apprise the trial court, verbally or in writing, of the circumstances. It doesn't appear that any JDF 208 form need be completed or submitted. And Mr. Shea qualified for counsel under these standards throughout the proceedings. He was in the custody of DOC and unable to make bond at the time he was originally deemed indigent and appointed counsel by the district court. And he remained in custody and unable to make bond at all times, in no small part because of the prosecution's efforts to force him to retain private counsel and then its later efforts to increase bond.
Mr. Alta, when he was initially assigned the public defender, his reason that he was unable to make bond was because he was serving a sentence, not that he was unable to post bail?
He was in DOC custody at that time, and so obviously wasn't in a position to post bond.
Couldn't post bond.
No.
He's not eligible for bond.
No. And I mean, based on my own experience, and I'll just throw this out briefly, but when I was at the appellate division of the public defenders, in most cases, the clients who we represented were deemed eligible for representation because they were, virtually all of them were under DOC sentences.
Even if they had, as apparently this gentleman had, some money set aside, or in this case, in a trust, he's still eligible just because he can't earn income? Is that the idea?
Well, it's not clear from the guidelines, and I've tried to sort of puzzle my way through it. I think that the idea is this, that defendants who are unable to make bond or are under a non-bailable offense are in a really precarious position, irrespective of what their financial circumstances might be. They're in a position where they're going to have to fund a legal defense without any ability to be employed and earn income. And I think there's a recognition under the Chief Justice directives that you may well find, what I really think it is maybe more a matter of practicality and efficiency, because you will likely run into a situation, which is essentially what we ran into here, where you have a defendant who expends the money on private counsel, and at some point in the midst of the proceeding says, I don't have any more money. I can't hire an investigator, may not be able to pay my lawyer. And that creates tremendous inefficiency in the system. And I suspect that part of the idea behind that guideline under the fiscal standards was to avoid that type of scenario. It may also be a recognition that there's an element of state action there that can potentially be troublesome. When you have DAs going in and requesting unmanageable bails, or the defendant is being held as a statutory matter on a non-bailable offense, there is an element of state action, the potential to interfere with.
And this was an unbailable offense, as you call it. The bond was never set, is that right?
Well, no, the bond was actually originally set, I believe, at $500,000. I mean, it was a significant amount of money, but after the DA successfully challenged his eligibility, and he was forced to retain counsel about 2 or 3 months prior to the time he was released from DOC to the Denver County Jail on the Denver detainer. The DA moved to increase his bond to $1 million and placed him in a virtually impossible situation.
But if you were to take the position that his assets, assume no income, or at least no earned income, he has substantial assets that may be highly illiquid. In other words, he can't sell them, can't get to them, can't convert them to cash, and his lawyer is going to require cash. And so rather than just even consider the nature of the assets, under these circumstances, we don't consider them. Is that?
Well, I mean, and I think that's part of the recognition, too, is that a defendant who's sitting in custody faces a number of very practical and real obstacles to securing private counsel, the ability to access the funds, maybe liquidate assets in order to retain counsel, and simply the ability to contact counsel, which there's record support for that in this case. It sounds like Mr. Shea had tremendous difficulty finding counsel in this case. I'm going to move quickly to the waiver issue, and it probably doesn't need a lot of explanation, but our position simply is that given that a waiver is an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of a known right or privilege, Mr. Shea couldn't abandon or relinquish a right that he didn't even understood he possessed. I don't think he had any understanding that he possessed this right. Everybody seemed to be operating under the erroneous assumption that it's purely a means-tested, means-based inquiry, and it's simply not under the Chief Justice Directive. I'm going to move very quickly to our argument under the UMDDA. The thrust of the argument is simply that the Uniform Act requires that when a superintendent of a prison is placed on notice or has knowledge that a prisoner has charges pending against him, he or she must give the prisoner written notice of the charges. And
how was this
through the filing of the detainer, which in this case was the arrest warrant that was served and executed.
That was a detainer, or was it a complaint, a criminal complaint? I'm confused.
Well, it was that this case proceeded by indictment. After the indictment was handed down, an arrest warrant issued out of Denver District Court, which was then executed.
But that wasn't a detainer.
We submit that it was.
How was it executed?
I think the most that the record reveals is that it was executed in Fremont County. Mr. Shea was... I think the evidence is quite clear, was at CSP at the time, which is in Fremont County. I think the court can take notice of that. How exactly mechanically it occurred, I don't know. I know that prison officials had to grant somebody access, or they executed it themselves as peace officers under Colorado law.
Well, but I mean, so are you saying that the superintendent was under constructive notice of this execution of the warrant, or... What is the notice that's required for the superintendent?
What Yellen says is that it's the filing of a detainer.
It needs written notice.
Right.
And the detainer is directed to the superintendent, is it not?
Under Colorado law, all it has to do is notify the confining authority that the fact that there's pending charges out there, and that they're to hold the defendant and turn him over for prosecution. That occurred in this case. They clearly understood that they were under an obligation to hold Mr. Shea on this, and they transferred him to Denver County Jail on this detainer. At the time that he was released to parole on his DOC.
Is there any evidence in the record that the superintendent knew that this warrant had been executed, or isn't the prison records that he with this warrant in the prison records, or what?
I don't.
Or do you know?
I don't think actual knowledge is required.
Well, constructive knowledge would be it's in the file.
Right, and I think that that's, when Yellen says that it's a filing of the of a detainer that provides the requisite knowledge, it doesn't say much more than that. And it was a departure from the Supreme Court's prior opinion in Lewis, talking about actual knowledge. I see that I'm out of time. With that, we'd ask that the judgment be reversed or vacated.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Majid Yazdi, registration 36043, representing the people in this case. I will start with the question of the indigency determination. In response to Judge Roy's question, definitely income is not the only criterion considered in determining indigency. As the definition suggests, an indigent person can be, the determination is based on the financial circumstances, and that is exactly what Chief Justice Directive 04042B refers to. An indigent person is one whose financial circumstances prevent the person from having equal access to the legal process. So it is clear that when the court wants to determine whether a person is indigent, all the financial circumstances have to be considered, and definitely assets that can be liquidated are part of this calculation. And Mr. Shea's case shows that a person can be incarcerated and still have access to assets that can be liquidated because he was able to hire a private attorney, retain private counsel for some time until those assets were depleted.
Let me stop you a minute. Does the prosecutor have standing to bring this question before the court?
As the Chief Justice Directive suggests, whenever there is a change in the status, financial status, it is a duty of defense counsel to bring it to the attention of the court, and based on the new information, a new determination should be made. How this information is brought to the court is not the critical factor. So the fact that in this particular case, the prosecutor found out and brought it to the attention of the court does not in any way affect the validity of the court's determination, because as was suggested, the prosecutor could have notified defense counsel, who in turn had the obligation to present the same information to the court. And the question of waiver, the waiver was effective. Mr. Shea was represented by counsel at that time, and the counsel conceded before the court that based on the new situation, because now he had access to the trust fund, he was not indigent anymore. There is nothing to question the knowingness of that.
What about the argument that his financial circumstances don't make any difference if he's incarcerated?
Hypothetically, or in this case?
Well, in this case, he couldn't get out on bond. He was incarcerated. Counsel seems to argue that when that circumstance exists, his financial condition is not relevant.
That's my argument, Your Honor, that the Chief Justice Directive and the definition of the term indigent clearly suggests the criteria should be based on financial circumstances, not incarceration per se, because people can have millions of dollars in bank accounts and still be incarcerated. Does it mean that they can't use those funds and those assets to hire private counsel?
Mr. Yazdi, then what is the effect of the provision in Attachment C that states that the public defender may represent somebody who is in custody and cannot post bail?
As I have indicated in my answer brief, it authorizes public defender's office to use that information and assume and proceed on that basis, but it doesn't mean that incarceration by itself is sufficient to establish indigency, because incarceration may affect the ability of the defendant to access whatever funds exist out there. but not in every case, as again, in this case, we can see Mr. Shea had access. And it is unclear from the record before us why the court decided initially to appoint counsel. There was no application filed. And just because that could have been a mistake to begin with, doesn't mean the court could not have corrected it based on the new information and the arguments that were presented at that time. Regarding the question of UMDDA, the Uniform Act, the question before this court is how to construe subsection 3 of the Act, which addresses whether the question of the dismissal of the charges, untried charges, if the defendant, the prisoner, has not been notified within a year of the filing of detainer. The purpose of the Act is clear. In many cases, has been identified, the statute itself refers to it, that it is to implement the defendant's rights to a speedy trial. As a secondary purpose, the Act attempts to minimize the possibility of disruption of rehabilitation programs that a defendant may be entitled to. Another principle related to statutory construction and interpretation is avoiding absurd results. Even an interpretation may be based, a result may be based on correct information, but if it is absurd, it suggests that that result is not proper, because certainly the legislature did not intend to create such an absurd result. And I would suggest here that dismissal of the counts in this case is exactly the kind of absurd result that the statute could not have meant. The speedy trial was not violated. Defendant was notified and advised within 2 weeks of the indictment being issued. From that point on, the proceedings continued because of mostly inability of the defendant to be ready for the trial, because there was massive discovery, and that is also a finding by the trial court that there was no prejudice, because exactly it was the defendant who was not ready to proceed sooner for with the trial than when it was in 2008 actually happened.
Mr. Yazdi, would prejudice be a relevant factor under subsection 3?
It is our position that it is, Your Honor, because Higginbotham addresses subsection 2, which requires proof of prejudice. Trancoso, another case, also addresses the relevance of prejudice to section 1614.103. Under IAD, the case of Reyes also addresses the fact that prejudice must be established. And in fact, the defendant has the obligation and the duty to frame the issue in terms of what prejudice resulted. So when we look at the whole statute, admittedly, subsection 3 does not specifically refer to the issue of prejudice. However, when we look at the scheme of the statute, it is clear that in order to effectuate the purpose of the statute, which is a speedy trial or rehabilitation, that is the objective. And when that objective has been achieved, because instead of the superintendent, for example, in this case, the court advised the defendant, there can't be any reason for dismissing the charges just because the superintendent did not notify.
Well, doesn't the superintendent have to advise the defendant that he has certain rights under the statute, including the right to request an immediate disposition of the charge? And if the superintendent did not know, or the superintendent did not advise, he never was aware of the right to an immediate disposition, which starts the clock.
The clock is actually, that's the point that I was going to focus on. The clock starts with the filing of the detainer. And it is critical in this case because no detainer had been filed. So the superintendent did not have the knowledge to even trigger the duty that is imposed by the statute on superintendent.
He hadn't been placed on formal notice. Counsel says he had the knowledge, but he hadn't been placed under some sort of formal notice that the detainer statute was implicated. Is that accurate?
You mean there's actual knowledge, but...
He actually knew the charge was pending.
There's no evidence of that, Your Honor.
Well, I know that's what counsel is arguing, however, is that knowledge is sufficient.
Mr. Walter simply argues that because, and I'm reading from the reply brief, it is entirely possible that prison officials served and executed the arrest warrant in this case. It's not in evidence that that happened. Whoever served Mr. Shea could have just walked in, asked for him, served him personally, and gone. There is no evidence of any formal paperwork filed with the prison officials to even function as an equivalent to a detainer. And the case of Tucker that I presented to the court in my answer brief addresses those rare and exceptional circumstances where a formal detainer has not been filed, but still an arrest warrant may function as the equivalent of a detainer. We don't have that here because the prison officials were not notified that, were not requested to hold the defendant until based on the new charges. So there was no notification. An arrest, and as the Tucker case makes clear, an arrest warrant simply requests immediate arrest of the defendant. It does not make a request for future holding of a prisoner based on the charges that are have been recently filed. So those distinctions are critical in this case. And because there has been no formal detainer file, even defense counsel notified the court that he went through whatever procedure was available to him to see if there was a detainer and there was an advisement and reported to the court there was no detainer filed. And that is exactly the kind of ambiguity and confusion that the statute tries to avoid by saying that a formal detainer needs to be filed and the clock starts with that filing.
And that's under subsection 3,
yes,
where it uses that language, not 2. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's the claim made by the defendant under subsection 3.
Who issues the detainer?
Either the prosecutor or at least in most cases that is the case, but if I'm correct, other authorities, maybe Sheriff Kent.
It's not a court document. I mean, the trial court here didn't issue a detainer.
No. There was no detainer issued to begin with.
Well, I understand that, but certainly couldn't prove it by looking at the trial court's records.
So the indictment is not a detainer?
No, Your Honor. It is not considered a detainer. And from my understanding is that prison officials have certain established procedures for processing detainers. And that is why when defense counsel contacted prison officials, there was no record of a detainer.
Well, Mr. Yass, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Obviously, the superintendent could not have the information based on the records existing in prison.
Well, let me ask you about the records existing, because I believe there was a parole agreement that mentioned a Denver detainer. So was that evidence that a detainer had been filed?
The parole board had some information about that, Your Honor, but definitely that does not, that information cannot be imputed to the superintendent because the procedure is not the same thing. The parole board may have information that is not before the superintendent, and that was, in fact, the argument made below. Mr. Walter has abandoned that argument and now argues that it is the arrest warrant, not the parole agreement, that is the basis of that.
I think I understood that he was abandoning the argument that the parole agreement was a detainer, but that it may be evidence that a detainer had been filed. And so just based on that, would that be some evidence that a detainer had been filed?
It is unclear what the parole board had before it based on what information it reached that conclusion. But my argument is that that in itself does not establish knowledge by the superintendent in itself.
So the defendant can be denied his rights under the act if the officials fail to issue a detainer.
I'm sorry.
The defendant can be deprived of his rights under the act because the district attorney or sheriff's office, whoever's involved, does not issue a detainer.
If the detainer is not issued, Your Honor, the case law is clear. It does not even trigger the duty on the part of the superintendent.
I'm just taking that one step further. A defendant may be denied his rights under the Detainer Act for failure of the appropriate official to issue one.
But that is not the only option that the defendant has. Under subsection 1, defendant can file a request himself, which did not happen in this case.
So there are
2 ways that the superintendent can be the responsibility of the superintendent can be triggered. One is the detainer, and one is the request by the defendant. So those two are part of the requirements. If neither one is met, obviously, then he's out of luck. I see my time is up. Unless the court has any questions, I will ask this court to affirm defendant's convictions.